One simple rule is whoever is giving advice on stocks or MF, just stay away from them.
But Lalit runs the largest brokerage platform in the country, and he's saying which is important.
Yeah,
it's serious.
Day trading is a very, very serious stuff. Not meant for like 90% of the folks. And one best thing about starting early is that you can make mistakes and you will not go broke.
Yeah.
Right? You can't do those kind of mistakes, let's say at 40 or 50, right?
A lot is happening. My India story is no longer about Bangalore, Hyderabad, yeah. Delhi, Mumbai. Last year, UP grew by 19%. And that's, you know, just a mind-boggling level of growth.
I don't know anybody who knows how to time the market. Markets, think of it like if you're an engineer, there is a system where there are like millions of inputs, and a lot of these inputs, which are human beings, are irrational a lot of the times.
Yeah.
How can you predict the system?
All right, Lalit, welcome. Looking forward to this conversation. I think I've had the pleasure of knowing you for last 7-8 years, and it was great to collaborate with you also in the early days of Grow. So let's just start with the early days of Grow. Mm-hmm. And I think this was not your first startup. I think you have tried your hand in entrepreneurship before also. So by the time you got to Grow, what was the thought process? What convinced you that building a company for making investing easy for people is something, you know, which there is a potential large market, or were you even thinking of a large market, or you're more focused on just building a, you know, differentiated product?
No, large market was definitely a big focus area. So when you do your second startup, there is some rationality along with passion, right?
Yeah.
And the way we looked at it is like, and we discussed a lot in our early days, right? That India as a country will continue growing. Like, we are probably at the best, in the best times of our kind of journey, and then India is a very young country, young folks. The wealth of these folks will continue growing, and like, and then we have this unique opportunity to build something for this growing market. Secondly, again, practically speaking, if you look at the value generated in India, the profit pools and the market caps in India, financial services is the largest. And then coming from Flipkart, then you also look at numbers. Okay, 1.4 billion people, but let's say 300, 400 million middle class people, and how many are actually have access to good quality, high quality financial services? Mm-hmm. Like, I remember when we started thinking about mutual funds, there were like 20 million investors in the entire country, which did not make sense, right?
Yeah.
So these were kind of thought process at that time.
And what are the numbers now? How many people are now investing in mutual funds?
So I think 40 million plus 45 million people.
So last 5-6 years has doubled. I'm pretty sure Grow is playing its part also in making a lot of people probably come to market for the first time. Do you track how many people start their investment journey with Grow?
Yeah, so approximately 60%, 60 to 65% of our customers are first-time folks. They start journey with us. Mm-hmm. But then now, when we started, it was a little higher, like 65%. And now it's around 60%, because now a lot more mature folks have also started coming in, because other products they don't like, and then they move to Grow.
So let's a little bit, I want to just touch upon the market size and the profit pool in financial service. So let's just talk about, from the, I think, however you look at it, whether in terms of listed companies, total market cap of financial services companies, or total profit pool, what are the macro numbers, which to support this idea that, there's a lot of value creation in India is happening in this category?
So, yeah, so before market cap and profit pools and so on, just look at the impact of financial services. Mm-hmm. Now in your daily life, right? So one aspect is money part, which is like just spending, like money is just to spend. But then the moment, and that is how we were before, when we were like hunter-gatherers, it's like very transactional life. But then the moment you start thinking about future, then you start saving. So wealth comes into picture. And then if you want to grow, but you don't have capital, you take credit. So then credit comes, credit, future growth. And then you protect yourself, that's insurance and so on, right? So, and now the beauty is that everybody needs this. Yeah. Like, so that's what we call, right, OT, kapda, makan, and then financial services. It's like equivalent, like education, internet, everywhere you need financial services. So you touch everybody's life in any of the, you touch everybody in any of these aspects. And then, of course, if you are generating value, to fair, then revenues, profits, and market. And then you come to the market caps, let's say in India, I think financial services would be, I don't, maybe 30% of the market cap, maybe. We can check, right. But that would be like...
Rising than the 30 to 40% range from last
year. Yeah, and it keeps kind of right now... Banks and all things are kind of they have not done well, but I think it's 30 to 40%.
Point you're making is that these financial services are integral to quality of life.
Yeah,
wealth gives you resources, you have some security about a future, it generates income also, right? And similarly, credit allows you to either start a business or even personal life, and you can afford products today and pay for it over a period of time. And insurance, bad things happen. Risk protection. So, and hence, because of universal appeal of these products, translate into
value generation translates into market caps.
Yeah. So early, just let's zoom into first 12 months of Grow. What were you? I remember, I think meeting you quite regularly during those days, probably every few months.
Yeah.
And I think, it's been 6-7 years now, but my recollection, a lot of discussion were about either product features or how to grow.
Yeah.
So what were you focused on, you and all your co-founders, in the first 12 to 18 months? What was most important for you in those days?
So we were very clear that, if we don't build the right product for the customers, if we understand the customer really well, then... everything else is secondary. Like, that is the most important thing. So we did not worry about any. So in general, what is HR, funding? Funding, we were lucky, right? We got some capital. But all the other aspects of the business are secondary. Even making money was like secondary. First, build something which customers really, really want and they love. So I think we did not do anything else. So even office space, we did not. We just borrowed office from friends and so on, right? And just focused on one thing.
The spirit of that is, music to my ears. I think you probably recall I keep using this phrase, product is marketing, that is my way of saying is product is that important. And there are many ways to, I think, build startups, and people prefer different things. But my preferred way would be you build a product so awesome that, customers really fall in love with the product.
And yes.
So with your intention of building great product, what are things you are doing on a daily basis, also the team culture and the skill set, how do you actually make progress towards building a great
team? See, one thing was sure, so you can, of course, talk to customers, interview, and sometimes, we also used to go before the movie starts, people are free, right, in a cinema hall. So you'll go there and you get an opportunity to talk to people and so on. But those kinds are fine. But I think ultimate insights come only when you build something POC or something, and then you launch it, and then see the expression of people, how are they actually kind of reacting, not by asking them, if you ask them, do you like this product, and they will of course say yes and so on, but that's not that kind of valuable. But if customers love that, they continue using that, they start talking about it to their friends, which is the biggest kind of thing, then something happens. And one thing what I think, again, that sense of productivity, right? A lot of people think that, okay, I will talk to 10 customers and then this is my good work. I'll talk to 50 customers, this is my good work. But it doesn't happen like this. The amount of input that you put in versus the output, there is no correlation. Sometimes you will just get one insight and then you build over it, and then there's massive output. So it's very non-linear in that way. And that's how we wasted a lot of time, by the way. We wasted I think we wasted around 1 year, easily.
Yeah. No, but that wasted looks like in retrospect. Would you, if you do this all over again, will you still invest that time, or you will do it?
I think so. See, I think I should correct myself. Probably it did not waste, but it built our culture. It built our understanding of the customer. It was not very productive from the sense of shipping and so on. But then there's this story I tell to my team also, trees that grow slow, right? They are very strong.
Yeah.
I was reading in this book by Morgan Housel, which is like how...
Same as ever? Well,
same as ever, yeah. There's a story there where if a tree grows small, it's much stronger, right? So I think that slowness at that time, the first 1 year, I think that made our company very, very strong. Our bonding also very strong.
Yeah.
And we saw like, sometimes you just show up, right? You get up in the morning, come and there's like nothing to do. But then in the low time is what the bonds are also built between co-founders, between the native members.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that surviving some kind of adversity together.
Yes.
Definitely, you know.
Yeah.
Increases cohesiveness among the group. I think it's a, I also think that a group of people becomes a great team when there are few both shared successes and shared failures.
Yes.
And failures sometimes leads to teams dissipating, but the teams that figure out how to ride that out and rally each other and survive, then you have all these war stories and you feel like, you know, we can come out of that. I mean, Curefood, our same thing happened during pandemic, you know, it was like brutal 18 months, you know, with three rounds of business shutting down three times in a row. But the core group pretty much stayed intact. And now, I mean, their confidence is, you know, sky high. They really feel ki ab to kuch bhi kar sakte hain.
True.
And the part of what you're also alluding to is that in the early stage, probably better to have less resources. The companies are raising a lot of money.
Yeah.
And on the, I think Curefood made some of those mistakes. I think we raised a lot of money in the first few years. And of course, you know, we also burnt a lot of those money trying to all kind of experiment in products. So I think a little bit that starvation, you know, going back to a tree analogy, like the trees that grow in the year of less rainfall, etc., their roots are a lot deeper.
Yeah.
On the, this building great product, you know, any metrics you focus particularly on how, like, with how do you know that my product is better? Or, and it's also not, I'm guessing you're not comparing with the other people out there. You have some absolute benchmark.
Yeah. So everybody's playing different games. So one mistake is like always comparing, you know, at least in early stages, if you start comparing with product you with somebody else, then you start playing their game, which is the one big mistake. But looking quantitatively, like there are four things I think which I try to look at. One is if your product is good, then acquisition should be very, very low. Like if you are spending a lot of money in acquiring customer, that means there is some gap, because if product is good, then people will start talking about it and then acquisition will come down. Second is very important, retention. If it is very low retention product, then the utility of your product is very low. Retention is like, what I mean by that is like, if a customer came in January, can they stay till December or next December, and like 24 months, 36 months and so on. The better, the longer it is, the better it is. Third thing is engagement. Like now this is a bit kind of like some people might not agree, but engagement is important, which is like, how often do people need you, right? How important are you in their lives, right? And lastly, like how much do they love you, right? How much, like, do they talk about? So love is not like, if you, again, if you ask somebody, okay, do you love like the product? And they will of course say yes, because they want to be good to, in India, everybody is so good, so nice. They will like, nobody will kind of hurt you. So love is like, which comes very, very loudly, like, you know. So for example, if I love something, then I talk about it to all the folks, right? And so on. So if I think about all the products that I use, like they are all recommended by somebody, like my shoes, this ring, and like, you know, everything basically, right? So that's the customer love.
This is just, there's four things. I agree with all of them. And there's some things that are so simple to state, but so difficult to put in practice, right? So you said first is, if people like your product, at some point, the customer acquisition cost should start to go down.
Yes.
If you see a trajectory that is not staying constant, that means you're kind of forcing. You're spending a lot of money on all these paid channels, somehow getting them in the door.
Yeah.
Right? So that retention, even if you force them through the door and they leave after 6 months, there's a leaky bucket, a classical problem in most, you know, people who try to force artificial growth, but ultimately the bucket is always empty, no matter how much pouring from the top. Engagement is again, you know, okay, so I'm aware of Grow, let's say, for example, or in our case, Cult, but am I using it regularly, like, you know, buying stocks or going to gym regularly, or versus, you know, I just have the membership or I signed up for the account, but no engagement. And customer love is also other thing, you know, which is, it's like one of those things, you know it when it's there. People can't stop talking about it. Okay, great framework, agree wholeheartedly, but what does it take to build this? I mean, it's these, like most startups will die on one of these three four things, right? It's so hard.
The problem is it's very hard. Like it's n so in the hindsight now I can tell you how we built it. But even today, if I build a new product, I think it will not be a simple framework for me. It will so for example in Grow also we launched a lot of products. Not everything worked. And we know this framework, like we know this four things, you know, this should work, but then also we fail, right? So it's very hard, right? I don't know. I think feeling like there's a feeling, right, that comes. So this will work,
No,
right?
but see, this framework also, this is capturing the output metric in some ways. You can measure all this. But from input point of view, how do you set it right? Let's say today you are starting a, even within Grow a new product. What input conditions and what culture will give you a better chance of arriving at a, you know, better numbers?
So they so I'll so there are a few frameworks that again not very full frameworks. One is which is the probability of success is very high, which is being a user yourself. Like so for example, investing was relatively easy for us because we were the users, like very, very power users. Today, even today I use like Grow like maybe 1 to 2 hours a day because I'm power user of the product. So that is one framework. You really feel the need, and at least you are the customer. At least one customer you have got, right? So a B2C, otherwise B2C products are very hard to build. So you have at least one thing that there's one customer. Second is there are some products where customers are very vocal. Like in Grow framework also, we might have like 10, 15, we might have 15 products, but they're like three or four products where we don't need to decide the roadmap. Customers like shout, like, you know, that we need this. And then there is no question about it. This is what third is like stampede creation. Like, you know, stampede creation is like if you build something and it was just so much in demand that there is literally stampede that happens. Like,
Queue outside Apple stores.
they have done phenomenal kind of brand building and so on. But I think even new products sometimes create that kind of stampede. Fourth one is relatively easier when you're a large company, when you have a lot of data, then you can start looking at the Clickstream data and see what are customers looking for. Sometimes we also do like we also so one thing that we do is that let's say we launch a product at a very small scale and let's say remove it for some time and then see what is the real utility of that. How much one survey also we used to do, which was called a disappointed survey. So let's say I ask customer if I remove this product, how disappointed will you be? And then they should say very disappointed. Many of them should say that they will be very disappointed. Otherwise, it's not a high utility for the customers.
Yeah, cool. All very relevant frameworks and mental models for people to potentially think about. I think I just want to go back to this one of just being a power user and for a B2C. I'm also again able to personally relate. I think in my Myntra days, I used to buy so much clothes and shoes. I had, I'm not even kidding, a couple of hundred pair of shoes by the time I was done. My Myntra stint. And similarly, I mean, I love fitness. I mean, these days I work out less at Cult, but I work out every day. So that may, you know, have able to relate to. I think that's probably at least for B2C companies, founders should think about, you know, do you have a genuine passion for what you are building? Otherwise, it will be secondhand that, you know, trying to service a metric, but you have no personal, you know, relatability. I mean, Ankit, who's our common friend and was, you know, co-founder at CureFit earlier, you know, he has a genuine passion for food. And now, you know, the externalized cured foods, and he's doing really well because he really like, you know, right. So I think that's probably one signal, both among the founders as well as the product managers, the people who are engineers who are going to work on this. Like, if they're disconnected, then probably.
Otherwise, it's very tough to build magic. Like, if you're not passionate about, especially in B2C, I don't have any expertise in B2B, but at least in B2C, I think passion is very, very important.
I think B2B also, I feel there's a different type of passion because it does require a lot of selling. So you have to enjoy meeting people, and not everyone enjoys, right? You know, like I worked for two enterprise software companies in my early days in Silicon Valley, and I did not like at that time, at least, you know, just going out, doing all these product demos, meeting companies, waiting for the purchase order by the fax machine, literally, right? Didn't like it, you know, and so my product is not very well suited to build enterprise, you know, company, at least, you know, at that time. So a little bit of self-awareness, right? You know, what do you really like? Probably. Because today, say not, you know, last few years, we look at, you know, there was the crypto trend, and then there was metaverse, and now AI, but they all require certain type of people with certain, you know, passion and interest.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
AI is at this core is very technical.
Yeah.
If you don't like computer science, don't like going too deep into it, keep building superficial solution. Right? So is that something you look for the initial teams that, you know, let's say when a new initiative grow,
yeah,
how will you build up? What in your mind, what's the ideal team to give best possible shot to a new product?
Best possible shot to give a new
for best possible shot for new product to improve the chance of success.
Success, so,
which kind of people you'll want to work on a new initiative?
Oh, people, yeah. So when we so long time back, I think you also reviewed that document that we created, which is called Grow Code.
Mm.
And in that Grow Code, there are 10 commandments.
Yeah.
Commandments are like very serious thing. Like these are non-negotiable religious stuff. Right. And there's one commandment, which is like, you need to be power user of your product.
Mm.
Right. And so in general, if you're not passionate about what Grow is doing, then I think it's very, very difficult for somebody to kind of survive at Grow. And then there are also some people who are very good with 0 to 1 products,
mm-hmm.
and some people who are very good in scaling. And interestingly, the natures are very different. So it's very tough for a scale person to do like 0 to 1 because they feel very loss of like productivity loss, right? Because they are used to impact like millions of folks, and then you are talking to one person.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's one thing that kind of has worked decently for us, like figuring out people who are really good at figuring out. So founder personality is very good at 0 to 1 kind of thing. And then they need to learn scale. But if you hire, let's say, a very senior person from, let's say, Flipkart, who has done like millions and so on, and then they come and see, oh, we are building this product with like 4 engineers, and then I'm used to like leading, let's say, 100 engineers, it's very, very tough.
So you're mindful of seeing the propensity where someone is likely to both passion for, you know, what you're going to build, as well as
scale.
Scale, like comfortable with not having any scale and just doing working with few engineers, few customers, you know, which is what makes, I guess, 0 to 1 that much more painful, because you really have no big fulfillment or, you know, big numbers to feel good about. Just talk more about your Grow Code. So I know, I mean, along with the product, I think I've been in the past conversation, I've noticed that you really almost you've tried to design along with, you know, co-founder, certain type of culture.
Yeah.
And Grow Code is, you know, one enabler for that. A little more of a thought process about Grow Code, how it came to be, and also what has it done for the company so far?
Sure. No, so before that, I mean, I want to thank you for one specific line that you told many years back, right, which still is kind of embedded, which was like, so we are product builders. But when we start thinking about the organization is our product, not the app or not the website, right? Which was very powerful. And then, like, we wanted to build an org, like, which is very, very long-lasting, which is, like, enduring org, very high competitive advantage and so on. And we started with this value of customer obsession, customer focus. And we also seen how when orgs kind of grow very large, what the ultimate purpose that you start with, they kind of try to they start diluting, because kind of, you know, your culture kind of gets diluted and so on. So we thought, okay, let's write it down, what we want, and this is like our, like, you know, how why do religions survive so long? Because they have set of, you know, commandments, they have set of rituals and so on, and we thought, let's do that. So many years back, like maybe six years back, or We wrote a doc, which is like Grow Code. Grow Code is a specific way in which Grow works.
Yeah.
So we have 10 commandments there. We have our value system there. We have, you know, how to hire people, how to kind of, you know, grow people, and all those kind of things. Very kind of objectively written.
Yeah. And is this document evolving? Like, have you gone back in a bit?
Yes, a bit. So some changes happened, but the core still remains. Maybe we got a bit better in getting, like, you know, I remember the first version had, like, you know, this thing where, okay, Grow wants to make, financial services simple. And then I remember you had put a comment, and this is not looking like a very, very large purpose. And we did not do anything then, but after a few years, we realized, oh, our purpose is to empower people by making financial services simple, delightful, and transparent. So Now the end is actually something else. Mm. That was a means.
Right.
Making financial services simple and transparent is a means, but ultimately the objective is to empower people.
Right. Oh, that's amazing. And I want to just add to it. I'm personally, you're using the phrase grow code. I use the word constitution, but the same thing, you know, the like you borrowed from religion. All countries have a constitution, which basically, how is this country going to function? What are the fundamental things we believe in?
Mm-hmm.
And what is our way of operating? So I think it's a very, I have tried to the last 7 or 8 days, whichever company I'm part of, let's try to write a version of constitution, and almost thinking like constitution also evolve. You can literally have amendments, as the need changes. So I think, a lot of startups can benefit from that. This at some level, if it doesn't matter, what structure one uses, but whatever fundamental, guiding principles, core values, policies, rituals, you can think of, which is going to help translate your vague vision into something concrete that other people can also read and try to abide by. That would, I think, help, that can play a big role. I hope a lot of startups, if they listen to this, think about what is their current constitution, if there's our code, if there isn't one, they try to write.
Yeah, in fact, we are planning to open source, we'll probably make it open. So
amazing. Open source to employees or all customers?
Employees, of course, everybody has access to it, but everybody else also, now we also want to lot of entrepreneurs also come for help and so on. Maybe if it helps in some way, then so be it.
That's amazing.
There's nothing secret there.
Yeah, next level revolution. And good companies, if you can, everyone can read, the principles that, Google lives by or Amazon lives by. I think it's in some ways creates some level of transparency also. Everybody knows that.
Yes.
Sometimes it's very difficult to live up to, Google's don't do evil. How relevant that is. But they tried for a long period of time. And there are many other principles, about generally transparency and empowerment and so on. I think so. It's good to be transparent about these things. Speaking of, open sourcing and opening, just sharing this aspect with the larger ecosystem. So the broader Grow ecosystem is humongous. You guys are now the largest online brokerage company in the country. I think you said also largest distributor of mutual funds in the country. All that is just 7 year time frame, which is pretty insane.
8 years now.
8 years? In less than 10 years, getting from basically nothing, a startup with, I think your seed funding, if I'm not mistaken, was something of 5-6 crores, like a very small amount of money. And from there in 8 years, so obviously you and your co-founders must feel great about being there. But now, how do you look at, this is a larger, user base that kind of relies on Grow for their empowerment through access to all these financial services. How do you think about as a custodian for that large user base and doing something about, continue to improve their life and enabling access to their products?
Yeah, so see, for us, Grow will continue growing if our customers are growing.
Yeah.
And we think from three perspectives, what we talked about, wealth, wealth of people should grow. So today, Grow overall, there would be around $20 billion worth of wealth managed on Grow, which is quite decent, and that would continue growing. So people would continue building wealth, and wealth brings a lot of independence to people, a lot of decisions that they can take, better decisions that they can take. Then there is credit, which is relatively much smaller for us, but it's a very long runway. I think the credit penetration in India is low, and lastly, protection, which is insurance, which is a bit far away, but again, that's another impact that would create. Mm-hmm. So if people's financial services are well sorted, they will be able to grow faster and they will have meaningful.
What are the macro numbers in India? How many people overall either, buy stocks, buy mutual funds? How is that number growing year over year?
So 2016, something happened.
Mm.
And
Grow happened, obviously.
We were lucky. Grow, of course, we leveraged the tailwinds. We were very lucky. But there are few things that happened which really, really helped the entire ecosystem, where number of stock investors grew manyfold. Mutual funds grew. AUM grew. Everything, So it's also very difficult to find exact reasons, but few things are very clear. one thing that happened was this so-called digital public infrastructure came into.
Yeah.
And that is like mix of a lot of things, actually. So, for example, before Grow, before KYC, like, you know, people had to actually sign on forms.
Yeah.
I opened my DMAT account like 20 years back, one of the leading kind of banks at that time. And it was a very painful process. But then came Aadhaar, Digital Locker, eKYC. So a bunch of things that happened. Then UPI came. So transactions became very, very seamless and everything. Then then internet kind of... So my first startup failed because you're building a streaming platform and there is no bandwidth. It's just like very stupid now if you think. But now that is not a problem. People are used to shopping on Flipkart. People are paying through UPI and so on. So I don't feel very uncomfortable in, let's say, buying or doing an SIP of, let's say, 15,000 rupees, right? Or 10,000 rupees. So these are the kind of big changes that happen.
Yeah.
But then if you look at the secular trends that, like, India has been growing for, like, decades now.
Yeah.
Like, we have been compounding, like, 6%, like, 5 to 7, like, you know, it changes. But no other country compounds today at this rate, right?
So overall, I think the India stack impact, it's probably very quite pervasive and I don't want to say underappreciated because I think these days, you know, everyone also talks about it, but probably, you know, maybe at a headline level is very clear, but at grassroots levels, you know, really what it is enabling for financial inclusion and access to financial services is probably still maybe not very widely known.
It's tough for us to realize that.
Yeah.
And especially for us who are sitting here, like, you know, in Bangalore, which is a bubble.
Yeah.
But then when we travel to, like, smaller cities, meet a lot of folks and see the changes happening around, it's like, then you get the feel, then you get the impact.
Right.
Then you feel the impact.
Yeah. We want to go back to that. If you know the numbers, off top of mind, you approximately, like, just when a country of 1.4 billion people, today how many people, you know, are participating in the public market, you know?
Yeah. So retail investors, there are a lot of DMAT accounts. There are 100 million plus DMAT accounts, but that's like people open and then the active investors, traders in last, let's say, 12 months would be around 35 million to 40 million. Mutual fund numbers, again, there are folios, which is like publicly available. There are a lot more, but then unique investors would be around 40 million.
Got it. And this is across people who are buying direct stocks or buying some kind of mutual fund?
Yes.
Including debt funds?
Yes.
Got it. So this is the total universe, approximately, let's say, round number, 40 million annual growth in this number? 8-10%?
It's again very, very... there have been years when the numbers don't... So like last year, for example, the number of active stock investors actually was degrowing for like 6 months. Mm. And then this last few months has been like... Again,
right.
So we came down to, I think, around 31-32 million from 36-37. So then again, now it's kind of rising again. So there's a bit kind of volatility there in short term, but in long term, like, again, that's why, like, I don't remember a lot of these macro numbers because I have kind of trained myself to not look at macro numbers.
Yes.
Because sometimes they get very distracting in short term, like, you know, and that's why, like, Even if you're looking at macro numbers, look at like 10-year numbers or 20-year numbers, because our industry is like that. Like, you know, be it wealth, be it credit, be it like, it's all very kind of in short term. You can make wrong decisions if kind of you look at.
So, but okay, let's look at then the very long term macro. What is a comparable from other, you know, developed markets? Let's say in US, what percent of the population would own stocks and mutual fund?
Very high. I don't remember the latest numbers.
So I will even look it up. I will probably fact check and, you know, put it as a caption. But I'm guessing at this point, I don't know, but must be, I think, 25-30%.
No, more than that. 50% plus.
So that's out of 400 million people, nearly, you know.
200. In Nordic countries, it is 100%.
Whew. Wow. Yeah. So which is great, you know. So if you look at, you know, very long term, I mean, we're saying we're at 3% today of the population.
Yeah.
It just, you know, even getting to 10%, 15-20% is just massive.
That's why I think that's all, like, I keep telling, which is like, about numbers, we don't need to worry about.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I think in this, I mean, of course, it's true for grow and financial inclusion, but almost true for pretty much any industry in India. If you manage to get to some penetration, let's say, you know, I mean, I'll use a fitness example also. And today we are the, you know, by far largest fitness company, but fitness penetration in India is 6 million fitness users, which is 0.4%. US that number is 20%.
Yeah.
So good thing is, and you can see that, you know, very 20, 30 year, you know, growth runway ahead of you.
Yeah.
Even if you get to 5% penetration, there's 10x growth in market.
Yeah.
Which is obviously, you know, people in India will work out, you know, everybody wants good health. I know you are a big health fanatic, you know, last few years, and we will come back to that later. But yeah, I think, you know, we can see that. So it's I think almost applies to nearly any industry. That's the beauty of 6-7% compounding that we are seeing in GDP. And but most consumer in industries are growing almost between 10-15% CAGR, and there's no end in sight.
Yeah.
So in the early days, you know, a lot of your focus was targeting those first-time investors. And I think the picture, you know, I think we discussed also, the first-time investors, somebody, let's say a Flipkart engineer who is probably 25-year-old, 2-3 into a job, starting a surplus income. So let's extrapolate from there. The people who are in their 20s, how should they think about, you know, if they are not participating in the market, what is the mental model that they should think about? You know, you've read Morgan Housel's books, right? He talks about this in both of his books. So what is your translation to when you're talking to somebody in 20s? So think about their financial health from a, you know, long-term point of view.
Yeah. So this, I've spoken it many times, but one thing is that starting early is very, very important. Like, it's like swimming. Like, you can read a lot of books and you can do it, but ultimately you will have to do something. And one best thing about starting early is that you can make mistakes and you will not go broke.
Yeah.
Right? You can't do those kind of mistakes, let's say, at 40 or 50, right? So that is very important. Second thing is, like, investing, or in general, being aware about money management, finance management, is, I think it builds us, like, you know, our personality also. Like, we get a different perspective in life. And then also what happens is, typically, so for example, grow customers are very prudent, very, very smart. So recently there was this stat about how few people did nominee for, and gross percentage was 2x of that, and so on. And I think it's because they get exposed to, like, so many things, they become very responsible, they become very prudent, and also then you start reading a lot, right? And then you get, again, your mental model, like, you know, the frame of life kind of keeps getting added, and maturity comes, and so on. I think that's very important. So more, I think, I started investing when I was in college, and I think I might have made some money, but more than that, I think how it helped me, so it helped me understand business. Like, I don't have an MBA, but how do I know about business so much? Because I read so much, and I, like, you know, investing has taught me that. As a person also, like, you know, you become curious, because this company is doing this, so you want to know fitness, let's say, you want to understand it. Okay, how is the trend of people going? And then you understand psychology, and you understand, like, you even go to concepts like physics, and you kind of, so that's like the beauty of all of it, I think.
Yeah, both Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger are like, Charlie Munger unfortunately died, but voracious readers, right? You know, I
mean, yeah.
Munger, I've worried that he would read almost 6 to 8 hours every day across all disciplines, including physics and biology and
everything,
and somewhere it helped inform his perspective. But coming back to, again, you know, this the younger people, I mean, one is, okay, starting early, you have the benefit of compounding, you know, whatever you do, you can, you know, compound for 30-40 years. But one thing you don't have in your younger years is patience. You know, I also got into investing in my early 20s, but day trading. I actually talked to Nitin also about this. You know, I was day trading like mad, and just, you know, because you feel like, you know, see, historically, you know, stock markets give you 10% returns over a very annual return over a very long period. But when you're day trading, you know, stock price obviously fluctuates.
Yeah.
And you may see 10% happen over 1 week, and you feel, you know, you brag, what, you can correct also 10%.
Yeah.
So what's that patience? You know, I buy and hold for 3 years, you know, that's very tough ask for someone in their early years.
No, I think it's still like a small price to pay to learn patience
right.
in early years. I'm sure you did day trading then, but now I mean, I'm sure that would have made you better, like have more patience now, right? I think it's like journey of life, but patience is very important. I think I don't know how to get that patience. But market teaches you to some extent.
Yeah, maybe I'll just say, I think for the younger folks listening to it, it's just, you know, I mean, given Lalit runs the largest brokerage platform in the country, and he's saying patience is important,
yeah.
Take it seriously. And I agree, I mean, 100%, you know, for me, that day trading was so traumatic, you know, I just stopped investing for a long period of time, and eventually
yeah.
I eased back myself into it, you know, just very conservative mutual funds.
Yeah.
And increasingly, like, my whole investment strategy is changing. So I just want to hold for a very long period of time.
Yeah.
I don't know that, you know, plus I'm obviously not an investment professional. I don't have insider knowledge or able to analyze a particular industry. So, but I know that, you know, long-term holders, you know, create most value for most people. I think going back to, again, Berkshire Hathaway, from what I understand, my numbers were slightly off, but 80% of money they've ever made is from 10 stocks, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah,
it's like very high concentration.
Yeah. Well, see, so there's nothing bad in day trading and stuff. The problem is that people get into it without understanding what it is.
Mm.
Right? Day trading is a very, very serious stuff. And not meant for like 90% of the folks.
Yeah.
Options, futures, like they are not meant for most of the folks. For most of the folks, what is best is like invest in index funds or some mutual funds. Or if you can understand businesses, if you understand an industry, then invest in stocks, like for long term. If you really understand what day trading is, then it makes... So day trading is like a business, by the way. Investing, so... And then there is a third category, which is like game, right? So one is wealth.
Yeah.
You're really building wealth. So $20 billion people who have built this kind of wealth on growth, they are investors.
Mm.
Then there are traders. A lot of them are very, very smart traders. Like they make money every day, every month. And they are like, they treat it like a business. They have like P&L.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is my investment. This is what my profit is, or this is my losses. And this is what, like, I look at it objectively, right? Nothing is bad. But what is important is you understand what you're doing.
So you're saying day trading is basically like a profession. And some people can choose to have, and I know some day traders, they really do this full time and they pour over all the reports and so on. They will have they'll at least try to have as much of an understanding about a category or a player as the analyst do. But for most people who are just getting into investing, broad rules to think about debt investment, mutual funds, direct stocks, what percentage of their income they should consider investing? Like, how does, let's say I've never ever done any investing and next few years I want to start, you know, building my portfolio for the long-term wealth. So how should I just go about it?
Yeah. See, one thing, the beauty is that the moment you put in your money, you have skin in the game.
Yeah.
And then that makes you understand all these things. And then it almost becomes like a rabbit hole. You read this, then you read this, then you know. So, and then you become like, so basically you won't need kind of to know what to read and what you will find yourself, right? But just don't kind of get into the tip market. Like, you know, there are a lot of people who are kind of giving you tips and advices. Like, one simple rule is whoever is giving advice on stocks or MF, just stay away from them. Like, right? Second thing is...
Yeah, the people really know they will buy themselves.
Yeah, this is like very, very simple logic, right? If I know there is a 100 bagger out there, I mean, why wouldn't I just do that? Right? Second thing is that, second beautiful about the percentage of income and so on. Second thing is that the markets are just so kind of, so when I started with 80 rupees. One of my wingmates got an internship in one of the listed companies. And that was like shocking thing that there's a listed company and the stock price was 80 rupees. And student, you don't have much money. So you don't need to worry about that. So if you want to buy real estate, for example, I don't think you can do it at very, very small amounts. Or so learning is, so market gives you a lot of kind of options to learn. And this is one of the things, like, you know, you start with small amounts and then you can figure out, okay, where are you inclined towards? How much deep you want to go? Let's say you can really understand companies. Okay, what does QFIT do? What is it? You know, how is their, how does their P&L look like? How will they expand? How will they grow? What is the management like? Then you get into individual stock picking. If you think, no, this is, I don't have this much time, then you pick mutual funds. In mutual funds, then again, you figure out, okay, can I understand about mutual funds? Who is the fund manager? What are the kind of stocks mutual fund is investing in? What is the kind of past return, right? And the holdings and expense ratio and so on. Like, there's, if you look at the product page of Grow, there would be like all these information. Now, if you think, oh, this is interesting, then you get into mutual funds. If you see, oh, this is too much, then you just think about index funds. Index funds are what, like, they just kind of, they're no fund, like, you know, there's a market, you're betting on the entire market, you're indexing on the entire market. So if index does good, you will do good. There is no stock picking there, right? If you think you can't understand index fund, then you, like, you know, if you have a lot of money, then you can hire an advisor. If you can't afford advisor, if you don't understand stocks, if you don't want to invest in stocks, if you don't want, can't understand mutual fund, then FD is an option, right? But itna to fir samajhna padega.
So one is, like, I think people obviously should consider having some portion of their net worth into public market, because, and whether it's India or globally, I think over a very long term, like, I think at least going all the way up to last 100 years, the public market is given on average 10% or so of return. So it's given. The only thing is, obviously, there's ups and downs. You know, it's not going to be straight line.
Yeah.
1 year. So a little bit, you may see your principal shrink for a year or two, and that's where the patient comes in. You know, you have to think really long term. I think timing, buying a particular stock based on any tip or analysis, that one can do, but then you have to commit also to learn that much about that.
Yeah.
And kind of betting on your skill that you are able to see something, what the performance of the company,
yeah,
or management team will do that.
Yeah.
Right. And then, you know, probably just any mental model to think about different risk categories, like direct stock with highest risk versus mutual fund versus index.
Yeah. So in mutual fund also, beauty of mutual fund is, like, mutual fund starts from here, like overnight liquid fund, overnight fund is like, it's like very, very safe, right? And then on the other side, there are sectoral funds and small cap funds, which are like, if you are investing for an year and if you are saying, oh, I'll invest in small cap funds, it's not a good decision. Small cap funds are not bad, but they are bad if your investment horizon is like 6 months. So any investment product, you'll have to think from horizon perspective as well as your risk perspective. So small cap funds, like in 2008, the micro cap fund went down by, I think, 60% plus. Like, can you digest that?
Yeah.
If you can't. And also there is difference between risk tolerance and risk capacity. Now, right now, when I'm talking to you, I can say, oh, I can digest 20% loss in my entire net worth. But when that really happens, then you behave very differently.
Yeah.
Our emotional state, our, like, state of mind is very different. So you need to be so I think in investing, the more aware you are about yourself, probably you'll be a better investor.
Yeah, no, 100%. I think, and yeah, I guess that whole, you know, concept of self-awareness keeps coming up, you know, whether about company building, what kind of founder you are, or, you know, what kind of constitution you want to write, or what kind of investor you want to be. So a little bit of, you know, maybe we can talk a bit about that, because, you know, you were sharing with me earlier this morning before coming here, you meditated for 1 hour. Now, these days, you know, a lot of people are aware about meditation is a good tool. We have also talked about that in this podcast. But typically, most will think, okay, let me do 10 minutes of a guided meditation. Why do you meditate? Does it just because of your own inner peace? Does it help you also a better professional, better person? Like,
no, my thing was very simple. Like, I was like, I am just so exposed to data, information all the time, right? And very hyperact, like, always need action. Yeah. And I think I realized that it was hurting my productivity a lot, because I think focus is very important. And I think getting insights are very important. Like, getting real insights and making right decision is very important. And for that, I think your mind need to be very calm. And I think there are various ways to keep myself taking a long walk or focusing on few things or doing lesser things or meditating. These are the kind of things that came to mind, and that's how kind of meditation.
Do you think meditation can help someone become a better investor?
I don't know. Maybe. I don't know.
I think ultimately investment is about making decisions. You're absorbing a lot of information. Like there's macro information, micro information somewhere. I mean, whether to buy a stock now, and let's say stock corrects by 10%, whether to sell and exit, you know, and minimize your loss or hold for next 5 years, they're all decisions. And somewhere, you know, whatever makes you a better decision maker and also self-aware. I think, you know, some people have, as you said, you know, can't tolerate a correction in their net worth. And if you can't tolerate that, then anything beyond index fund, etc., is become very tricky because stock markets can correct any 10, 10, 15%. It's not a big deal at all.
Index funds also can correct.
Index funds, relatively less, they will correct at the macro level, but you know, if let's say you're more small cap, etc., or more concentrated portfolio, the correction may be much bigger. But yeah, and if someone is aware that you can't tolerate that, then maybe you keep much lesser portion of your portfolio in the more volatile. So I think I feel meditation is universally helpful. Can help with everything, including being a motivation investor, you know. I think there was, we saw that in the 2020 panic, right? When the market start, you know, correcting because of the pandemic, a lot of people completely exited their portfolio in that panic. But, you know, I'm sure they're all regretting and came back in the market at a much, much higher level year down the line. But I think just building on what you're saying is, even historically, the longer period you look at, it starts to become more and more stable and predictable. So if you look at last 10 years, last 20 years, last 30 years, so that is, you know, much easier to extrapolate in bigger chunk of time versus in a smaller chunk of time.
I would put it in a slightly different way. I would say the probability of losses keeps going down as the holdings grow. The probability of loss is very high if your duration is like two days. But if it is very low, if it is like 5 years.
So I think, you know, maybe good practice for people who are coming to market, if you have 100 rupees to invest, just keep investing 10 rupees over the next 10 months, or you just pace it out so that, you know, instead of worrying about it. And then also, as much as possible, come in the long-term horizon and have a few-year holding period, which also helps with the taxes also lower, you know, with the
And another maybe mental model is like in markets specifically, if you're doing direct stocks, then invest the amount that you can afford to lose, right? If you think that, okay, you are going to need this money for your something in next 1 year or something, like don't risk. Like markets are very good teacher, but they are also very brutal, which you have seen many times.
Yeah, correct. No, makes a lot of sense, I think, you know. I guess same applies for early stage investing as well. Yeah, so you have to not assume, you have to believe ki wo to chala gaya hai, kabhi aa gaya wapis, to that's a bonus, but otherwise, you know, it's just the risk is, you know, that much higher. These days there's a lot of you know, talk and hype, and rightly so, about, you know, whatever phrase you want to use, you know, India century, or there's just a lot of genuine excitement, which I mean, I moved back to India from US in 2007. Even at that time, I was excited about India. That's why I moved back, and kind of my feeling that was that India is, you know, really starting to take off. Things were slow to take off, but I mean, last, you know, 15 years, I never felt this sense of euphoria, excitement that has kind of built up in last couple of years. And you know, I'm, you know, earlier you were talking about, you know, how there's probably one company in the world which has compounded 25% over 25-year period, which is a shocking stat to me. I was not aware of that. But just from India, where we sit today, you know, both from growth point of view, if you look at multi-decade, and your perspective in India, you know, what is just your big picture thinking about where we're headed?
See, one thing is, so on the entire globe, I think if there is one country that can compound for next like 50 years and so on, that is India. And there can be various reasons. I don't know about those reasons, but mostly people, right? Young folks, demographics is one of the biggest factor. Digital public infrastructure is another factor. The entrepreneurship, the tech, our understanding of languages, tech, all these. I mean, again, we are not experts, but there is one thing is clear that India is going to grow for next many decades. And then over that, there will be specific business opportunities which will, so let's look at financial services. Now, penetration is so low, right? And the rate at which kind of, if we continue, even then you have a very, very long runway. So penetration, tech, these are like two big leverages for us.
Yeah.
I think that's how I think I try to look at things and don't think too much. I mean, because you don't have any option.
Yeah. I think even one thing I'm thinking, you know, earlier I mentioned something happened in 2016. I'm thinking, say, in 2016, our per capita income would have probably crossed $1,500. Now we are at about $2,400. There are probably some milestone that, you know, when the per capita income, the GDP crosses a certain threshold, maybe some new things become, you know, enabled, you know, the, you know, from roti kapda makan to probably other, you know, quality of services. At some point, you know, insurance coverage is still very low. Maybe there's an inflection point of that. Maybe, you know, we'll also hit some of those inflection point over next 5-10 years. And if you just believe all the projections that in the, I think, real term, the GDP growth is 6-7%. But in nominal terms, it's almost 11-12%. And if you look at that, you know, so probably as we hit $5,000 and $10,000, maybe, you know, whole new set of things will, you know, be possible in the country.
So some cities we are already in India. So I was in Surat last. Surat is the fastest growing city in the country today.
Yeah.
And not just Surat, if you go to tier 2 city, like you go to Lucknow, you go to Prayagraj, you go to Indore, you go to, like, you know, the infrastructure, not digital and physical infrastructure is just so good there, right? Yeah. And then people are exposed. All the brands are there. All the foreign brands are there. All everything. So you are, you, your quality of life is just as good. And then there are income sources, their business, self-employed, there are jobs and everything. I think there will be hiccups, but I think...
Yeah, I mean, speaking of, you know, this, looking at micro lens of, you know, let's say, I don't know, I was aware of Surat's, you know, growth number, but someone was telling me just yesterday that last year UP grew by 19%. And that's, you know, just a mind-boggling level of growth, right? If they are able to, I'm guessing 19% may not be sustainable, but even if 10-12% consistently over the next 10 years, you know, will completely transform the state.
Yeah. No, it was, so I actually, we do this trips to tier. So because as I said, like Bangalore is a bubble, right? So you need to get out. So we, I visited UP last year.
Yeah.
I visited South India last year. This year we went to Gujarat and so on, Madhya Pradesh. So we, you can see the difference. You can feel the difference.
And just tell me more, like, how do you organize these trips? Because I want a lot more of that. I don't do it as much.
So there are two ways. One is the very structured program, Ab India Karega Grow, basically, where we have touched like more than 100 cities. Every week, we go to 2 cities across India. But then we founders also, we do a like a trip where it's not a, like a fanfare, but you go meet some customers, go to their houses, go to their shops, talk to them, spend like 4 or 5 days in these kind of cities. So I think the biggest advantage is that it helps you empathize. So you know about the problems, like because data se sab pata chal jata hai customer ko what is the problem. But the way you can see their lives, right? And it's also been a while. So I am from a tier 2, very small town.
Which one?
But it's a Khargone, it's a Madhya Pradesh, like very small town. But then it's been 25 years. 20 years I've been in like in Bangalore and 5 years at Bombay. So you kind of tend to kind of forget, right? This helps you kind of live through those kind of moments again.
So this is amazing. I think, you know, for all of us who have interest in India, I think nothing can come close to, you know, actually being on ground.
Yes.
And absorbing the vibes and people's aspirations, dreams, challenges, what's happening. Because a lot is happening. I mean, India's story is no longer about Bangalore, Hyderabad, Delhi, Mumbai.
Yeah. And I would recommend to do local stuffs like traveling in train, traveling in local rickshaws, or, you know, roaming around in the local markets. Like, you know, so I think that gives you bigger... Because the hotels and flights, they have kind of neutralized everything. You go to a hotel, you eat the same food and you sleep in the same like AC and everything. So you don't learn anything. But I think to learn, you need to get out. Like you need to live local. I think that's one very interesting kind of learning I had over the last few years.
I mean, that's, I think, one thing I'm going to probably borrow and adopt in my life. I think I definitely want to learn a lot more about India. Any, you recall any unique insights that stem from or at least strengthening of an insight from some of these visits?
A lot of them. So I think whenever we come back, we just write down a lot of insights. So I'll tell you a few of very interesting ones. So one question I ask everybody is, when was the last vacation you had? And where did you go? Can you guess where do people go on vacations in India?
देखो ऐसे ग्रोइंग अप आई ग्रो स्मॉल टाउन हरिद्वार हमारे सारे वेकेशन तीर्थ स्थान वाले होते थे
यस सो दैट हैज नॉट चेंज्ड नाउ अगेन व्हेन यू कम टू बैंगलोर एंड यू आर गोइंग टू वेकेशन ऑन लाइक यू नो ऊटी एंड स्टफ और वॉट एवर लाइक यू नो हिल स्टेशन एंड वॉट नॉट बट मोस्ट फॉर मोस्ट ऑफ द पीपल इन इंडिया योर वेकेशन इज स्टिल सम टेम्पल और सम यू नो रिलीजियस प्लेस अनदर थिंग लाइक अगेन I was in, so we travel local and I was in an auto and suddenly auto stops and one lady gets in. And I was like, what is this? Mm-hmm. And sharing auto is norm, is not, so default is sharing auto,
Correct. Right?
And then there are some also city flavors, a lot of kind of different city flavors, different kind of, so you also try to ask question, okay, what is the origin of this food? What is like... Mm-hmm. You know, those kind of things. A lot of interesting things as well.
And some of the smaller towns when you go, you do also run into potential, the current grow customers or potential grow customers. What I'm trying to get to is, if you really go to a very small town, how is youth from that town thinking about, you know, participating in the markets, etc.?
So we meet a lot of grow customers only. Like, and what we see is, again, the smartness and the kind of knowledge that they have. Like in my time when I was in a very small time, I think nobody knew about anything. There was no internet. Like internet was very, very rare and we had very local knowledge. Yeah. But now people are very smart. They know how to do business. They know how to negotiate for their salaries. Yeah. They know what is AI, what is happening around the world, right? So the smartness level has gone up in spite of TikToks and, Insta Reels and YouTube Reels, like, you know, they are lowering some of the, but then we don't see the upside, the exposure that people are getting. And I think smartness level is increasing in all these cities.
Actually, I'm going to get into a little bit of brainstorm mode for 5 minutes. I think in this podcast, I would have to tell the stories of tier 2, tier 3, tier 4 towns a lot better. Suggest karo, like what's the best way to really capture that, you know, and communicate, because otherwise, you know, I may end up talking only people, you know, who are part of Bangalore, Delhi, Mumbai ecosystem,
yeah.
And who are observing, who read a lot perhaps, but like how do you bring out the pulse of, you know, because in some way, if the country of 1.4 billion people need to be India century, it is all those towns,
yeah,
hundreds,
yeah,
of them have to participate in that in a bit.
Yeah, no, very interesting question. But one irony,
All
these folks, like you are from Kanpur, right?
No, so I grew up in Haridwar.
Right. So almost all the entrepreneurs, mm-hmm, if you trace back, like majority of them are from tier 2, tier 3 cities. Mm-hmm. So it's just that the time duration they have been out,
correct,
has been little more. But then I think... It's not like tier 2, tier 3 is different from tier 1. It's just the kind of...
Haan, but after 20-25 saal, you know, context goes away because you get used to it and you get a very filtered information.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, since you've been spending time and you've kind of prioritized it, grow, I'm wondering, like, do you have any suggestions of which kind of people or how to, you know, really what do you observe over the five-year trip, how to bring them alive on, you know...
Yeah, so a few things, maybe it's a bit controversial and we might have to... So one thing is, in a city has local liquidity, right? The way, like, we are fortunate to have liquidity of entire India. Like, when you build QFID, it's for India.
Yeah.
We'll grow, it's for India. But then there is local, a city has its own liquidity, which is like, there will be a big shot doctor there.
Mm.
Or there is a politician there, and so on. I think...
MTR.
Yeah. And they will have... so much local nuances. So politicians, they understand audience. Doctors, they understand their customers. Or there would be a big shop, local shop. The owner of that shop understands the customer really, really well. I think talking to them is like also very, very, very helpful.
Yeah, no thing. All the cities have the equivalent of those. You know, there's...
Yeah, and then experiencing the local liquidity, basically. Like, I went to Bharuch and it's a very small town. And what I saw that... in the evening, there's like, you know, on the road, इट्स ऑलमोस्ट लाइक फैन फेयर लाइक इन लार्जर सिटीज राइट. जैसे पेरिस में जैसे होता है रास्ते में सीट्स डाल के खाना खा रहे हैं और वो सब हो रहे हैं, तो फिर देन दिल्ली में हुआ, फिर नीचे हुआ इंदौर टाइप्स में हुआ, फिर नाउ अब नाउ सिटीज विद लाइक 5 लाख पॉपुलेशन ऑल्सो हैव इनफ लिक्विडिटी इन हाउस लिक्विडिटी विच दे कैन इन्जॉय लाइफ राइट एंड एक्सपीरियंस गुड क्वालिटी लाइफ राइट एंड दैट इज हैपनिंग नाउ इन स्मॉलर सिटीज
राइट.
सो इट्स लाइक
एंड ऑल्सो सीइंग लाइक फ्रॉम द ग्रो कस्टमर बेस द प्रोपोर्शन ऑफ स्मॉलर टाउन्स कंज्यूमर इज इंक्रीजिंग.
इट्स बीन सेम लाइक आई थिंक इंडिया का जो बेस इफेक्ट है दैट विल ऑलवेज बी देयर लाइक मोस्ट ऑफ इंडिया इज
Yeah, at some point, I mean, this inflection point should also come, but maybe we'll take. So for e-commerce, at least we know now, I mean, and I think when you and I were at Flipkart, almost 60% used to be top 10 cities. Mm. Now it is flipped. I think it's, you know, only about
40%. For us, it is very different. So top cities is smaller relative to population.
Sure, got it.
Now it is. So basically, in our, like 2013, 2014, the arbitrage of larger cities was much higher, like information arbitrage, internet arbitrage. Now that has gone down. So at least in Grow, we are seeing it as base effect.
Right.
Like, there is no difference.
Mm.
A person in tier 2, tier 3 cities has the same amount of knowledge, same amount of smartness, same amount of opportunity. Mm-hmm. That, opportunity may be slightly because liquidity of larger cities is much higher.
Mm-hmm.
Smaller cities is a bit lower, but I think if you look at the cost perspective, they are much better. So if you're making like 20, if you're making like 50,000 in, let's say, Bharuch versus 50,000 in Bangalore, I think that's much better.
Got it. Yeah, Lilith, as we, you know, get towards the end of our conversation, I want to just come back to Grow. I think from the best of my knowledge in last, you know, 8-10 years, I think Grow is one of the top few companies, you know, in terms of the scale, profitability, market leadership, you know, highly differentiated product. It's a pretty rare, you know, milestone to get to. You know, most startups don't get to this, you know, definitely not in the first decade. So having gotten here, like, what are your, you know, now dreams and aspirations for Grow? Like, if you look at next 5 to 10, and you, I know you said, like, you don't think too much macro long term, but I think you like compounding. So how do you see, you know, it's like, you know, I have not come this far to only come this far. And mm-hmm. this is, you know, the odds of being here is probably minuscule. But now that you are here, you know, what do you want to make out of this?
So keep compounding. Like, so for us, customer trust is the most important thing. And we know a few things which are very important. So just keep building that. And I think we can continue building for like many years in future.
Mm-hmm.
And just be, try to be lucky. Like we, I mean, it's, it was a lot of luck, mm-hmm. right, which got us here. And we are grateful about that, and we hope that that continues. And beyond that, you can't do much. Like, you keep compounding, and also don't get kind of disrupted. Don't kind of don't sleep.
Or disrupt yourself. I mean, that's other thing. You know, when you're too successful, and the fear is also becoming very strong. So, keep disrupting yourself, I guess.
Yeah, and we are also in business of a lot of responsibility. Mm. It's about people's hard-earned money.
Yeah.
So we need to be very, very conservative as well from that point.
Yeah. I think, you know, as the country grows and the, you know, per capita income goes from $2,500 to $5,000 and so on, financial inclusion is going to be a very big need. And I think, you know, I mean, there are obviously some great banks in India with huge offline infrastructure, but among the, you know, new age digital first company, I think Grow is up there. And I think there's an opportunity to build a, like, really lasting institution, which can, you know, which it already is, but can be in a much, much deeper and broader level, be, you know, integral part of all the financial inclusion story in India. And I think you are in a great shape to be able to do that. So just want to thank you for taking the time and having this conversation. I think I've enjoyed talking to you from the first day of Grow till whenever you get an opportunity. It's great to see your growth, you know, the impact you guys are able to create. And is definitely, you know, one of the role model companies for a lot of younger entrepreneurs to, you know, take inspiration from. So keep doing well.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Mukesh.
At Sparks, we aim to bring to you stories of exponential impact. We share in-depth analysis of what goes behind success stories. If you find our conversations interesting, you can join us by subscribing to our YouTube channel. You can also listen to Sparks on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or any other audio platform of your choice. If you have any suggestions on who we should invite or what topics we need to cover, just let us know in the comments. We are always listening, looking for ways to improve, and keep getting better as we go along.